This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about coverage of President Biden's $2.3 trillion infrastructure proposal, which includes funding to repair aging roads and bridges, rebuild school buildings and hospitals, modernize the transit system, rebuild water systems. There is so much in this bill. How have negotiations on Capitol Hill impacted the key provisions in the plan, including raising taxes on corporations and the wealthy, or in some cases, just bringing the taxes back to where they were before the Republican Party brought them down under the Trump administration? Joining us is David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, author of It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America, and editor of DCReport.org. Hi, David. Thanks so much for joining us, and thank you for holding there.
Glad to be with you again.
Well, great to have you, David. I first want to ask you a question about the price tag of this infrastructure plan. When it first came out, every reporter asked, how are we going to pay for it? Okay, that's a fine question, but that was the main question. And Dean Baker, economist Dean Baker, wrote a piece for you over at DC Report called $2 trillion over 8 years is a drop in the bucket. Can you talk about this?
Yes. Well, if you except the findings of the major civil engineering organization in the U.S., we have about a $6 trillion deficit in our public furniture, roads, bridges, dams, things like that, which overall get a grade of D or D+. $6 trillion is one of those big, scary numbers that's utterly meaningless. It's about $20,000 per person. And if you do that work over 10 years, now we're talking about $2,000 a person or $166 a month per person. And the reason we have this big bill is 50 years of malign neglect of the public furniture. It's falling apart. Not all of it. Some of it's just fine, but lots of it's falling apart. We have about one in four bridges in this country that vehicles go over are structurally unsafe. About one in 12 or one in 13 are really dangerous and could just suddenly collapse on us. And we have lots of other infrastructure that just hasn't been maintained. And when we don't maintain the infrastructure, it costs us money. The Truckers Association in Pennsylvania does reports on how much their members spend on front-end alignments, new axles, tires, and entirely junking trucks or trailers because of potholes and other damage in roads.
You know, you talked about the report card, David. I'm over at the report card for America's Infrastructure website. They say there is a water main break every 2 minutes in the United States, and an estimated 6 billion gallons of treated water is lost every day, enough to fill over 9,000 swimming pools. Growing wear and tear on our roads have left 43% of public roadways in poor or mediocre condition, a number that's remained stagnant over the past several years. There's so many facts to report about our infrastructure, and yet the story has really turned into a political one. Is this going to be bipartisan? Will Biden work with Republicans? I mean, I think the print media have done a better job of, than some radio segments on this, because you need some time to really go over this.
Well, Biden set out saying, here's my proposal, $2 trillion in round numbers, which is a good down payment on all the work that needs to be done, and said, I want bipartisan support. A group of Republicans and Democrats came back with a plan that he rejected. And the reason he rejected it is Biden said no one making less than $400,000 a year will pay any higher taxes while he's president. The plan included fees, and fees are the equivalent of taxes. Tolls are the equivalent of taxes. And so he rejected this. Infrastructure should be bipartisan. It should be an issue of what are the Commonwealth goods we need in order to prosper. But this is not a new phenomenon. We have been neglecting our infrastructure for at least 50 years after putting a lot of money following World War II in infrastructure, notably the interstate highway system that is sometimes called the Eisenhower Highway System. And one of the problems we have, Rose, is we often cheapskate on this stuff. 13 years ago, my wife and I, researching one of my books, went to Stockholm. And I said, well, if you believe Rush Limbaugh and people like him, we're about to enter a city where everything is falling apart. There's no goods for sale. People are wearing old, tattered coats. And, of course, people are very prosperous there. The stores are full of goods. And we went looking for a pothole. We stopped bus drivers and police officers. We went to City Hall. People thought we were nuts. And we finally had a city official said, oh, pothole, go over to Oslo, which is 8 hours away on the train, and go to the Iraqi war refugee camp, and you'll find lots of potholes. But anywhere else in Scandinavia, you'll have a very hard time. They take care of their public furniture, and they build it to a high quality level. So do the Chinese and all the new roads they're building. We keep building cheap roads. The roadbed is not deep enough. The asphalt or concrete is not deep enough. It's not well cured if it's concrete. And so there's this make work as these things deteriorate faster than they should. We built a lot of bridges in the 60s that were designed for a 50-year lifespan. Why would you build a bridge with only a 50-year lifespan? The Golden Gate Bridge, when built, was supposed to have a lifespan, and I'm doing this from memory, but I think it was 1,400 years. And after they opened it up that day for all of us to go take a walk on it on the 50th anniversary in 1987, there are reports that that extra weight from that one event had taken several hundred years off the lifespan of the bridge, but it was built for at least a millennium. And we should be building our public infrastructure to last a lot longer, not to create repetitive make work for road builders and water pipe and sewer pipe and other contractors and their employees.
To your point, David, about disinvestment, I mean, this applies to so many things in this country. Can you, because you're such an expert on taxes, you used to write about taxes for the New York Times. Can you talk about just how things have shifted so much over the last 40 years? I mean, if you look at even the Trump tax cuts, the Republicans in Congress in 2019 slashed the corporate tax rate from 35% down to 21%, a massive change. And a report from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy found that 55 corporations would have paid a collective total of $8.5 billion for the year had they paid that rate on their 2020 income. Instead, they actually received $3.5 billion in tax rebates.
Well, what we have done in a series of steps starting in 1981 in this country is completely redone our tax system. The income tax is really now a tax on labor and wages, and it's for large, sophisticated investors, business owners, hedge funds, people way up the income ladder. It's pretty much a voluntary tax at this point with almost no enforcement. Now, we will get a new report momentarily that may change this, but a year ago, the IRS reported that among super wealthy people, they audited seven of them, which meant if you were in the bottom half of taxpayers whose average income was about $17,000 that year, you were far more likely to be audited than if you were in the $10 million and up class. Seven people, and there are 22,000 households in the $10 million and up class of income. I've done analyses showing that since 1961, the average tax burden on the top 400 taxpayers, and 398 of them in 1961, fell by two-thirds. The federal tax burden for the bottom 90% was unchanged, essentially, because Social Security taxes went up over that time. And finally, after my writing about this for 25 years, a lot of other people writing about it, especially in the last 10 or 15 years, we are beginning to see the public waking up that we don't have a progressive tax system. And progressive taxation is no new idea. It's in the Old Testament. It's in the laws of ancient Athens. It is, therefore, a profoundly conservative principle. But we have made the tax system so complicated and enforcement so weak that it is now a massive subsidy system for people at the very, very top. And those very, very wealthiest people, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, they can live their whole lives without ever paying any income taxes because they can borrow against their assets for about 2% when the lowest tax rate they would pay is 23.8%. And then when they die, they can give everything to a foundation and get a 100% charitable deduction. So the government never collects anything. You and I can't do that. In fact, under the Trump tax law, we went from 1 in 3 Americans being able to get a deduction for their charitable gifts to 1 in 13.
So Biden's first proposal called for raising the corporate tax rate from 21% to 28%, which is still below what it was before the Trump tax cuts at 35%. And still, Mitch McConnell and Republicans say they're not going to budge on this.
Well, I think it's become very clear that the position of Mitch McConnell is as it was in the Obama administration. We are not the loyal opposition. We are here to destroy any Democratic administration. I mean, he said at the beginning of the first Obama administration, that his number one goal was to make sure Obama was a failed presidency and a one-term president. This is not good for the country, but, you know, look at the demonstrations, look at the reaction of many people to the failed coup on January 6th, and I think it's very clear that there is a significant minority, for sure a minority, but a significant minority of people who will give up democracy tomorrow if they can get guaranteed a white supremacist government. And that's a real interference in our politics. And right now, I don't think anything significant will happen on infrastructure. We'll get some kind of a bill, but the kind of real address that we need to public furniture, including internet access, it's not going to happen until either the next Congress moves us closer to being a corporate state with Republicans getting control of Congress again, or begin to become more of a state focused on the welfare of the mass of the people, as our Constitution calls for, the general welfare, by having more Democrats who will support this kind of public investment. So we'll get some kind of an infrastructure bill, but it won't be anything near what we need. And even if we get 2 years from now a big infrastructure bill, we still have to have a fundamental change in political thinking that it actually matters whether we have high-speed internet everywhere, that we don't fall behind as we have Bulgaria and South Korea in its rural areas, which have faster and much cheaper internet than we have in America, given how critical the internet is to commerce in the modern world.
Yeah, and a lot of Democrats, especially progressive Democrats, are saying we do not want a bill that does not tackle the climate crisis. Overall, David, we had you on so many times under the Trump administration talking about media coverage of what was happening. What has struck you the most about how the media have covered this issue, for example, other massive problems that we need to tackle today? Like, what's really stood out for you?
The biggest problem I see in Washington, and the reason that David Kirk, who lives in San Francisco, and I started DC Report, is we get quite good coverage of palace intrigues in the White House and political disputes. We don't get coverage of government. And it's government that matters far more than politics, but it's seen as not interesting. And that just shows the lack of imagination of journalists and their bosses, their producers, and their editors. When Biden came into office, I expected there would be, as there are with almost all presidents, Trump is an exception to this, a sort of honeymoon period. And now we're back to the normally screwed up federal government. It's just so big and has so many missions that all sorts of things go wrong. And the coverage we've seen so far has asked sort of tendentious questions, not serious policy questions. This idea that, well, nothing was accomplished in Geneva suggests to me that the reporters, at least the ones you saw on the televised snippets that were put out, they don't understand how diplomacy works. They have this idea that things just happen overnight. And a lot of journalists didn't go through a system where they had to learn how systems work, whether they did it by learning sports to begin with, because it's very binary and very specific, hard fact focused, or by covering local government, cops and city councils and things like that, which is, was my route, and learning how the government works. I mean, I've actually watched some national television reporters who do not understand how indictments work, and yet they're talking about them on television. And that goes to the fact that the fastest disappearing job in this century among white-collar workers has been journalist. And so a lot of institutional memory, a lot of in-house training have gone away. We're trying right now to get some journalism students to write for us, and we pay them, not a lot, but we pay them, as part of trying to train a new generation of journalists to understand how government works, how regulation works, so that they in the future, when I'm gone and David Crook is gone, can better inform the country.
Any pieces on DC Report that you'd like to highlight for people to know about before we let you go? We have about a minute left.
Well, on our homepage, I have a piece about the fact that incomes fell in 2019 under Trump. Nobody would know that if they didn't read my piece based on news coverage. And they fell a lot. The average income in this country fell by $1,140, $95 a month in 2019 before the pandemic compared to 18. And if you just look at people under $250,000, incomes fell significantly and are now back to when Obama was last his full year in office, 2016. In 2019, the 96% of people who make less than $250,000 a year were worse off than under Obama's last year in office. And yet, watching TV news and reading news magazines, and I take 40 of them, you would have no idea.
Wow. Well, David, as always, thank you for all of your reporting and your team, and we'd love to have you back for an hour conversation about what we need to do to get out of this mess. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and editor of DCReport.org. They report on what politicians do, not just what they say. David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. And you can find more information about David's reporting at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.